Hi, I'm Kevin Turner, and welcome to our 600th Real Estate Talk Show. It's hard to believe that 12 years ago we started a podcast in audio that would continue, would evolve and grow to be the longest running and, we believe, the first of its kind as a regular weekly show to educate, help and encourage people who want to invest in property as an owner-occupier or an investor. Look, there are so many people that I want to thank for their support over the 12 years, too many, in fact, to do so right now. But I would like to express my personal gratitude to the show's current team, especially Bushy Martin, who contributes a huge amount each week, and of course to our sponsors, Realty, BMT, Know How Property, Get Rare, and also Apiro Marketing. We look forward to the next 600 shows. Whew, it's daunting, isn't it? Well, kicking off this, our 600th show, Bushy poses a very good question. How is it that at the richest point in human history, we no longer appear to be achieving improvements in desirable housing outcomes and instead actually appear to be going backwards on many metrics? Well, in an attempt to unearth what's really going on with housing and what needs to change, Bushy talks to a leading housing commentator, Dr. Cameron Murray, who's the chief economist at Fresh Economic Thinking. That'll be up shortly. And then Mish Daniel, the founder of commercial property buyers agency Revolve Commercial, sets out to answer questions posed by residential investors wanting to diversify into commercial property. Hey, if this is your first time with us, welcome. If you like the show, please hit the subscribe button. Help us to continue to bring you the best guests every week. And you can join the conversation anytime on Facebook at the Property Hub Collective. We'll be back in just a moment as Bushy is joined by Dr. Cameron Murray.
Property deductions can save you thousands of dollars each year. To make sure you maximise deductions, you need to work with the most experienced quantity surveyor in the country. BMT Tax Depreciation is the leading specialist in the industry. They've completed over 700,000 tax deduction schedules for residential investment and commercial properties Australia-wide. BMT guarantee to find double your fee in the first full financial year deductions. Call BMT on 1300 728 726 today for an obligation-free quote.
Realty Talk and your host, Bushy Martin.
Now, Albert Einstein is often quoted as saying that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. And from where I sit, this pretty much sums up our approach to Australia's everlasting housing affordability and accessibility debate. For as long as I can remember, and I'm sad to say that's quite a long time, we've been continuously complaining about housing affordability. Now, the fashion and the lingo may change, but the housing mannequin of affordability remains the same, and it feels like it's getting worse. So how is it that at the richest point in our human history, we no longer appear to be achieving improvements in desirable housing outcomes, and instead actually appear to be going backwards on many metrics? So what's really going on with housing? And how can we effect meaningful change? Well, to get to the heart of the matter of this enduring situation, which affects each and every one of us, we're joined by leading housing commentator, Dr. Cameron Murray, chief economist at Fresh Economic Thinking, who recently appeared for a two-part deep dive on episodes 314 and 315 of our Property Hub's Get Invested podcast. And he's recently published his second book, The Great Housing Hijack, The Hoaxes and Myths that keep prices high for renters and buyers in Australia. So welcome to Realty Talk, Cameron.
Thanks for having me.
We had a great chat before Christmas, but now the book's out and about and a great time given what's being talked about in the media recent. So to get straight into the book, what are the key messages of the Great Housing Hijack?
Right. Well, I think the big one is that housing problems are not new. Every time someone tells me there's a housing crisis in 2024, I go, what about 2014? What about 2004? We had reviews and inquiries all that time. And my favorite quote is, From back in 1836, when Charles Darwin, the biologist, arrived in Sydney, and his diary entry for the first day says, "The number of homes recently built is truly surprising. Nevertheless, everyone complains of the high rents and difficulty in procuring a house." Of course, the population of New South Wales in 1836 was 20,000. And we've had multiple reviews and inquiries for 200 years into this problem. So the message is simply that housing markets are probably doing what they've always done. And when we look at the long arc of history, we can see the tension that makes solving housing so difficult, because someone's rental cost is another person's, you know, asset return. And this is what I call the symmetry of property markets in the book. And it's that economic tension that invades our political debate. And what I say, you know, there's a housing cheer squad who stands on the sidelines to distract us all from this core economic reality of housing. And so we do a lot of talking and very little action on housing, because we know for every winner there's a loser, and that just makes it so difficult. And if we, you know, if we look at history, the times where we did make radical changes involved wars or new, you know, if we look abroad, new nations being formed, and only then is the crisis really big enough to make radical change. So yeah, it sort of lays out the incentives for different people and why the debate continues, and looks at what's worked elsewhere.
Yeah, okay. Well, one of the things I'd like in the book is your discussion around the supply myth. So can you talk to us about that and the sort of associated distractions that goes with it?
Yeah, so the idea is, and you'll hear it every single day at the moment, that there's not enough housing. Of course, if you just go back 18 months, before this rapid population increase in the last 18 months, we had more, bigger, better houses per capita than any point in human history. We'd just had closed borders for a couple of years, and we'd had this pipeline of new construction. And you know what? People were complaining about housing then too. So it's really not a supply issue. And I think there's a key message I would put, and that is that people confuse density and supply. And I spend a lot of time in the book laying out the economics of housing and how the incentives work and what we can expect markets to do. And it lays out that, yeah, supply is about how quickly new housing at any density gets taken up each period of time, right? The density is distraction. When people say, oh, look, that one house converted to 100 apartments, so 100 extra, they're measuring on the wrong dimension. They're measuring on the density, not the supply dimension.
Yeah.
And so it becomes this great big elaborate political game of supply, supply, supply. And in the process of changing planning laws, you're picking winners with all these new property rights and where you're going to invest in new train lines. And so, of course, lots of property owners are happy to have that debate, knowing that no one's forcing them to flood the market with new homes and bring the price down. They're just getting these windfall property rights. And so, you know, that fits really neatly in the hijack debate of something we can talk about a lot. We can promise more supply, more supply, more supply. And on the other hand, promise we're not going to crash prices, we're not going to crash prices, we're not going to crash prices. And we can ignore the contradiction.
Yeah, extremely well said. Well, you touched on history from way back when we first settled. Round that out a little bit with what history is actually teaching us around the whole housing issue.
Yeah, so I think I spent a lot of time looking around the world historically, where and when have people stopped complaining about housing? Very rarely, let's just say. And, you know, there are a couple of good examples come to mind. So pre-World War II, Australian home ownership was in the low 40% in the cities. It's higher in the country because of land grants and, you know, after the First World War, soldier settlements and other grants. But in the cities, very, very low. So the majority were renters in the cities. Yep. By 1971, we'd got home ownership up to 71% in the cities. So we took a quarter of people out of private rental into home ownership with bigger, better dwellings than ever before. And we did that by basically subsidizing them into homes and building them with public money. And we also had a lot of rent controls during that period, which made landlords sell because they weren't making a good return. They'd get better returns elsewhere. And many people became homeowners. And if I look at that experience and I look at every country I could find, It is these big public efforts to offer people non-market rentals or non-market housing that have really changed the face of the housing debate. Now, whether that's you know, in Europe after the Second World War with the Million Homes program in Sweden, or whether it's Singapore's Housing Development Board, which is a public home ownership system that got home ownership from 20% in 1965 to 88% at the end of the 1980s. These are the transformational things we've done in the past. And I think perversely, we now assume that if we let the market rip, we'll get all those outcomes that we got in the past when we really offered a great big, you know, had a huge public hand in orchestrating better housing outcomes. And I think that's part of the hijacked debate is we expect markets to deliver something they've never done. And I want to sort of transform the debate and go, yeah, market's great. They work for most people in Australia. Home ownership is 67%. We don't have to fix anything for them. We've just got to take this sliver of renters and give them better options, whether that's public home ownership, subsidized rental or some form, and we'll build it up over time. So next time in the property cycle, if rents rise 40% in 2 years, well, guess what? Instead of 33% being affected, we're down to 15%. Okay, we've solved most of the problem, and especially those people most squeezed. So I think that's a totally reasonable approach. It's what's worked historically, but it's really not on the policy radar at the moment.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that because I guess, as I mentioned in the opening, I'm old and crusty enough to remember the days back in the 60s and 70s when public housing really was a safety net that took all the heat out of the exercise. And because of Thatcherism and the flow on to the privatisation debate, where government's now pretty good at pointing the fingers to the private sector to to have responsibility for everything, and a private sector that is always going to be just in time or just after time, actually, because it's about profits, it's about shareholders. Yeah. There's a built-in issue that flows from that, and it clearly there's a need for governments to step up and take some accountability for actual public housing provision is what I'm hearing. But rather than me say that, can you sort of summarise then what's the real true nature of the underlying problem and then flow into perhaps an expansion on your suggestion of housemate that may well be the solution to it?
So underlying problem is we're competing with each other for locations, and the ammunition for that competition is our wealth and income. And so low-income people who need accessible urban locations are always going to be squeezed. That's why low-income people cluster at the urban fringe. They pay a toll in terms of the time to commute to places because they can't afford that premium location. And so it's a combination of location and income in conflict. And so we solve that by subsidizing people into homes. And I have an example in the book. I mean, imagine if we only had private toll roads. Every road was owned by someone different. And they could set prices wherever they want. I would imagine we'd have a movelessness crisis, not a homelessness crisis, because people wouldn't want to move because they'd have to pay a toll to get anywhere. Yeah. And you know how we made transportation cheap? We just got a public option. Anyone can commute on these roads whenever they feel like. And we funded it collectively in a variety of ways, as we do with everything. What we did with
public hospitals are exactly the same thing. It's an underlying
schools.
Yeah, exactly.
People tell me I'm crazy. Oh, governments can't build houses. I'm like, you know, we just expect them to build schools in every suburb, nationwide, cities, country, and people move and they have kids at different ages, and then they have to build more schools and they have to hire the teachers. And it's a big complex thing. And you know what? It's so boring that it's controversial in certain locations. But imagine going, and I mentioned public schools, and when we decided, oh, every kid should have the right to school, and people go, oh, that's crazy, that's student politics, that's so ideological, oh, that's communism. And then we did it, and now everyone loves it, and we expect it, and we offer, and it's universal, right? The elite students from our capital cities often go to public schools.
Yeah,
it's not clear to me why we can build and manage schools, roads, and everything else, and not go, oh, well, you know what? Having housing options in the city for people at various income levels is just not something that the market's incentivized to do. Why don't we create that option? And, you know, it's not rocket science. I feel like it's just not on the agenda, but it's the only thing I could find that worked, right? So if upzoning and supply would work, I would have just written a book about why don't we upzone. But I couldn't find the evidence for that, right? Because that would be so easy. So it's actually a slow burn, difficult thing, and it's controversial and it takes time. You're going to be really bad at it at first, but unfortunately, that's the reality. So what I propose is what I call housemate, which is, you know, job seeker, job keeper, housemate, Medicare. It's just the Aussie policy program these days,
yeah.
But it's essentially copy what Singapore did, right? Because over 80% of Singaporeans live in public housing, right? The free trade mecca of Singapore is essentially everyone does public housing. And that just involves, like schools, building housing options in all the suburbs of our cities and our big regional towns, and people who don't have homes, which is already only 30%, and people who can, you know, we address the very poor and the homeless, you know, and we find places for them. But out of that group, we give people the option to rent or buy from the public housing provider at a heavy discount. And if they're happy in their luxury unit and they've got two dual income people and they want a fancy pool and a, you know, shared Tesla in their new apartment block, they can do it. I'm not forcing anyone, but, you know, everyone will have that option. And in Singapore, when you're 21 years old, you rock up to HDB and you can apply for a home from the public housing developer. And unless we're talking about that or some variation of that, we are trying to like pull this lever on this Rube Goldberg machine of economic incentives that have never worked before to get this outcome. When there's nothing stopping governments building houses and giving them to people who don't have them at any price they want at any time. And if there was a different way to do it, I would have proposed it. But, you know, all the tax tweaks, all the supply regulation, all of this, you know, we didn't have any of that when Charles Darwin arrived. We didn't have any of that in 1911 when we had the first New South Wales inquiry into rising rents and the first Fair Rents Act of 1915. And so, and that's where I end up. And I think, you know, if we could talk about houses more like roads and schools and just having the option out there for anyone is a normal thing we do without forcing, you know, anyone to change, without trying to orchestrate a collapse in the private market, then I think we're a long way ahead of getting to a more sensible outcome and a more sensible debate.
100% agree. And I think the core issue for me is responsibility and accountability in real terms, Cameron, because we have a history now of a political environment where there's a bunch of finger pointers that are always criticising someone else, but not really stepping into the space and saying, right, we're going to take control of this. So, you know, I guess my challenge to politicians and policymakers out there is to actually step up, step in, take control of this, because there's no losers in what you're suggesting. It's not materially going to affect the investors and the private market from that perspective, but it's definitely going to underpin and provide a safety net for those that are economically challenged to get into housing. So I see it as a complete solution in that regard. It just requires government to spend money on bricks and mortar rather than incentives and other places. They're still spending the money. They're just not doing it in areas that are going to have the right sort of impact.
Yeah, that's right. There's a big attitude, and it frustrates me no end, that if a government owns, so the public housing stock of New South Wales was worth $32 billion in 2012, it's worth $54 billion in 2017. What a great asset. I'll call it a housing fund. But because it's a non-current asset on the balance sheet, we get to pretend, oh, it's so expensive and costly. I'm like, you just made $20 billion for nothing, right? When you go home from work, right, you take off your work, you know, public service employee hat, all of a sudden, investing in housing in New South Wales is the best thing ever. You get on the phone to the mortgage broker, can I have $1 million to buy a house in Sydney? What a great investment. But then when it's on the balance sheet of the public sector, oh, it's a terrible cost imposition. What are we going to do? And that's a mindset shift that's, you know, part of the hijack debate. You know, we build homes for defense personnel. We make sure if you have to live somewhere because you're in the military, you have somewhere to live. Well, people have to live in the cities, right? Or in commuting catchments. And do you know what? Why don't we just treat it like everyone's in the army and give them an option? I don't know. It makes sense to me, but it does annoy people because it involves the government doing things and, as you say, being accountable for actually implementing something, which is very, I think, politically risky.
Yes, but it's worked before. It's not like this is new. What we're doing is really doing full circle back to what we were doing when the baby boomers started driving the market post-World War II. It worked very effectively then. Why wouldn't it do so now when we've got much better access to information and technology to make that
totally
happen?
Agree.
So it comes down to political will. But look, I know we've only just touched on this. We'll get you back to talk more about some of the great subjects that you've unpacked in the book. I just want to thank you for these really quite revelational insights, Cameron. And I certainly want to encourage everyone who's serious about really understanding the true nature of what's driving housing and property in Australia to grab a copy of your book, Cameron, from all good bookstores and probably a few bad ones as well as keeping up to speed with housing movements on your Fresh Economic Thinking think tank by clicking the link in the show notes. So thanks for joining us, Cameron.
Thanks, Bushy.
Successful property investment is a game of finance. Do you have the right team and the right game plan? Realty Talk is brought to you by Know How Property. More than mortgage brokers, Bushy Martin and his team of investment architects set you up with a sustainable strategy structured to lower your costs, tax, risk, and stress while increasing your capacity for growth. Know How has helped over 1,900 homeowners and investors secure more than $800 million in property wealth. So get set to live more, work less, and live your legacy. Want to know how to invest in your freedom? Visit knowhowproperty.com.au. This is Realty Talk, powered by realty.com.au.
Now, since COVID's turned the world of property upside down in recent times, there's been a lot of increased talk and growing interest in commercial property, particularly from investors in terms of the pros, cons, and differences with other property options. So for those of you that have invested in residential property and are interested in diversifying or transitioning into the wonderful world of commercial, or you're trying to work out whether to invest in residential versus commercial, you need to know what are the differences that matter and the ones that you need to know about when it comes to comparing residential with commercial property investment. Now, to help you with this, we're joined by commercial real estate buyer's agent, mentor, thought leader, and fellow podcaster, Mish Daniel, the founder of Revolve Commercial. So welcome to Realty Talk, Mish.
Hey, Bushy. Thank you very much. Lovely to be on your show. Thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah, looking forward to jumping into this because I know it's an area that's near and dear to your heart. And I guess let's cut straight to the chase and get into the meat and potatoes of what we're going to talk about. And I'd love for you to start by just outlining what are the distinct differences between investing in commercial properties versus residential properties.
Look, I think basically what we're talking about is two different, completely different asset classes. And despite the fact that they're bricks and mortar, they both are buildings on land, people often make the huge mistake that trying to do residential property or adopt the same mechanisms that you would use for residential property and applying them to commercial property, they're worlds apart. Now, the massive differences would be you're looking at residential, which is for moms and pops and everybody to go to sleep at night and have a good roof over their head, whereas commercial is really where you're going to go and earn your keep, where you know you're going to go and make your money. So often what we recognize is, you know, and this doesn't sound great, but I'm going to say it anyway, you know, you can live in a slum, but where you work, you want your workplace to look amazing because that is your front of place and that is where you're representing yourself to the world. You know, so often we see, and there's a lot of nuances around that we won't get into it right now because that will take us another 3 hours to talk about. but it's basically you've got your three sectors in commercial, where you've got retail, you've got industrial, and then you've got office commercial. And in those sectors, you've got your subsectors as well. So there's so many differences. I'm literally just, this is the tip of the iceberg.
Yes, I absolutely agree. And I think the key take home that I'd really like to reinforce is that there's certainly a world of opportunity in commercial, but don't start looking at commercial from a residential set of glasses because everything's different. Not only the types of properties different, but the way it's financed, the tenancy exercises are different. It's really, I encourage people to, one, have a good listen to your podcast, to start getting familiar with the terminology and the paradigms that, that will shape how you need to start looking at commercial property, and learn that language. It's very much like learning another language. And once you're proficient and fluent in it, then and only then, really start looking seriously at what are the key opportunities that flow out of commercial property. So I want to transition now, Mish, into getting you to talk about and really illustrate the key benefits of investing in commercial property.
Look, let's just to shoot straight through the heart over here. Everybody loves cash flow. So your biggest takeaway in commercial real estate is cash flow. And the reason for that is you've got a higher yielding asset. Now, there's risk and reward with regards that. Yes, commercial is a little bit more risky. However, if you're using the right mitigation principles, you can use that to your benefit. So, what do we do in using your skills? Or basically knowledge, I'm going to say education. You need to be educated to know what you're doing and how you can leverage on commercial. So the biggest would be, you know, in residential, you earning a gross income, gross yield. So you still got to take off all your outgoings before you're actually earning that cash flow. Whereas in commercial, we work on a net basis. So we look at all the outgoings and we say, okay, let's put those aside. But if you are yielding, let's say 6 or 7% net, then you know that that's what you're putting in your pocket, okay? So that's the huge advantage. The other difference is in commercial, you've got incremental increases on your leases. You've got long leases. You've got a lot of stability in those leases. Something that a lot of people don't know about is the difference between a residential lease and a commercial lease. They are two completely different animals, all right? In a residential lease, somebody can break the lease. In a commercial lease, it's very difficult to break that lease, okay? It's a legal binding document that holds them there. Should they break that lease, they are still liable for the balance of their lease term financially. So there's a massive difference with how you deal with that. Commercial it's called commercial because it is a commercial acquisition. Commercial is business, you know? So you're doing your business in commercial and your legals, your documents, your entire package, you need to understand the commercial side of it. So the legal side of it is paramount to the success of your journey in commercial.
Yeah, extremely well said. And I think it's important for those that are starting to look into this area to recognize that even from a legal perspective, if we're dipping into the commercial arena versus the residential arena, where the residential generally, the legislation is favoring the tenant, particularly in the current mode of things. And it's increasingly so as respective state governments start to tighten up on the residential tenancy legislation. My read, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Mish, but in the commercial arena, it's more an even playing field and potentially giving more power to the landlord or the owner of the commercial property than the tenant. Maybe not. But one of the things that I love being an outsider looking into the commercial space is that you mentioned those sort of net rental yields in that sort of 6 to 8% mark. Well, if we look at even a high yielding property in the residential space, net, once you take out all the costs, because most of the costs are being absorbed by the landlord in residential versus pushing a lot of those on costs onto the tenant in the commercial space, we're comparing sort of 2 to 3% net yields with 6 to 8% net yields. So coming back to your point around cash flow, there's a very clear opportunity there. So I want to switch now because everyone in property, doesn't matter what shape or form it is, focuses on the rewards. You've touched on a couple of these already. We need to look at what are the risks. And can you talk us about some of the risks associated in the commercial arena?
Okay. Well, I think when people think about commercial, the biggest risk that they think of is vacancy. Okay. And What we do in commercial is you want to mitigate as much risk up front. So when we're purchasing commercial properties, we're having a look at various different factors. Now, I don't think I've mentioned the difference between doing the due diligence on a residential versus the due diligence on a commercial. In residential, you're looking at two areas. You're looking at the building, the structure, and the area. Okay. In commercial, you're looking at about minimum five areas. You're looking at the building, the structure, you're looking at the area, you're looking at the lease, you're looking at the tenant, you're looking at the certainty of the tenant, so the type of tenant. What kind of tenant are they? Are they going to be a tenant that's going to be staying there for a long time? You're looking at the fundamentals of the property itself. So in other words, the fit out. Very, very important. And I think this is where a lot of people make a mistake. Is if you go into, let's call an office, for instance, you go into an office and they've got a whole lot of glass offices and beautiful carpeted floors and beautiful ducted air conditioning going through. Well, the first question that I would ask is, who paid for that fit out? Okay, because if your tenant paid for that fit out, what does it tell you? Your tenant is very invested in staying in that building. If your landlord paid for that fit out, your next question you'd want to ask is, did the landlord offset the cost of that fit out to the tenant? So inadvertently, the tenant would still be paying that fit out. And what does that look like on the lease? Again, you know, when people go and they spend $100,000 on a fit out or $250,000 plus on a fit out, it really tells you that they're invested in that building. They don't want to go anywhere. Okay. The other thing that we have a look at is incremental increases. So we want to make sure that there are incremental increases that's going to give you that added rental to a certain extent. And this, again, it's part of that mitigation of risk. Now, we do that. A lot of people say, but yeah, what about if the tenant moves out at the end of their term? You've got to understand that in commercial, you are earning a higher cash flow. And one of the reasons for earning that higher cash flow is that I call it gray funds, that you want to keep a little gray funds that would basically get you over the line for the next 6 months. Should the tenant vacate, generally in the lease, you've got between 3 to 6 months notice. So you can start marketing your property well ahead of time, so that by the time they do vacate, you can have somebody else lined up. I call it grey funds because those are the funds that you're going to use as an incentive to get a new tenant in and or pay your bills, your mortgage, whatever it is. And you don't really want to go longer than about 2 to 3 months. So it's a matter of being super active, working with a good managing agent that's doing that for you. And there we go. You tell me, Bushy, where's the risk?
Yes. Yeah. And then what I'm also hearing with that, Mish, is that just in touching on the things that you've mentioned, there's a lot more flexibility and correct me if I'm wrong again here, but potential to actually influence the outcome in commercial versus that a fairly restrictive environment that's involved in the residential space. Am I right in saying that?
100%. You know, you've got, we do a lot of change of use in buildings. So in other words, we've got a building, let's take a pizza restaurant, for instance. The tenant moved out, they've been there for 20 odd years, they've moved out. Well, you can change the use of that building to office use, okay? And the tenant that's moved in there is a physiotherapist, you know? So in doing that, you're doing an uplift on the fit out again, change of use, and you've got a multitude of different types of tenants that go in there. Next door, you've got a bicycle shop. You know, they could have gone into the same sort of premise. So you've got a huge variation of what you can do with that space. And it's not what you do, it's how you do it that determines what your outcome's going to be.
Yeah.
Commercial, let's not kid ourselves. Commercial is a lot more work than residential. You've got to be thinking, you've got to know, you've got to have the education and the thought of mind to see what is required in the area, so that you can target that type of business.
Yeah.
You know, or an opportunity where there isn't a physiotherapist or whatever it is, you know, and you target that business to get them in there, and that's where you add your value.
Absolutely. Now, beautifully said. Now, I've often said that property is a game of finance, and I know there are very distinct differences between the residential and commercial arena in that regard. So can you talk us through some of the differences in the financing, deposits, equity contributions, LVRs, loan terms, et cetera, so that we can get an appreciation of that?
Great, great question. So let's talk about the barrier to entry firstly. Okay, in residential, your barrier to entry is very low. I think you need a 10% to go into a residential property. Your barrier of entry in commercial, and I think this is probably the area that stumps a lot of people, is I would say first off, you need between 30 and 40%. So your LVR is going to be 60, 65, 70, average 65%. Okay. And again, that is very much tied into the type of asset that you're buying and your serviceability.
Yep.
So they're going to look at everything. The types of loans that you're looking at, essentially is three different types of loans. We've got a lease doc loan, which I'll come back to. You've got a low doc loan and you've got a no doc loan. Okay. Oh, sorry, a full doc loan.
Yep.
So your full doc loan is where they're looking at the asset, the leases, the stability of the asset, as well as your serviceability, everything in the kitchen sink. We do very, very, very few of those. Okay. Then you've got your no doc loan, which is the loans that we absolutely love, and we throw those out as much as possible, where they're looking 100% at the asset, the bones, the structure, the lease, the tenant, the security around the building and the asset itself, and very little on your serviceability and what you need. Now, the beauty about that is if you are unemployed or you don't have constant income, but you do have, let's say, 400,000 in cash that you're sitting on, it's burning on under your backside, you're only earning 2% out of the bank, take that cash, put it into commercial property. That will give you a property of between 1 million to 1.2 million. That is going to give you a 6 to 7% return. Happy days. Now you can do that on a no doc loan. Okay. And then the third one that I mentioned is a low doc, where they look at your serviceability. They also look at the structure, the lease, the tenant. Now, bearing in mind, with all three of these loans, you're going to get different LVRs. So if you're throwing your serviceability into it and you're a little bit tight on budget, which would be your deposit, you could maybe push that up to around about 70%.
Yeah.
Okay. Your 70% LVR. Whereas if it's a lease doc, it's probably going to push close to about 65, maybe 60. So there are variations right across the board.
Yeah, and I think the exciting thing there, given we're in an environment in the residential sphere where people are really struggling with borrowing capacities, given the rate rises and all the lender restrictions that go with it, the opportunity, if the quality of the asset's good enough and the quality of the tenant and the lease is good enough so that the property will virtually stand on its own from a servicing perspective, providing an investor's got equity that they can tap into, it's a way of leveraging into an asset class that they won't be able to enjoy in the residential sphere. So love that. All very interesting. And again, we're only just scratching the surface today, and we'll talk to you more about these subjects in more detail in the future. But for those that are pricking up their ears and their eyes are glued to the screen with interest, what are currently the sort of ideal commercial property investment vehicles for first-time investors at the moment, Mish?
Bushy, it's very dependent on the type of person that's coming through. Yeah. So, you know, ideally, you don't really wanting to be buying anything under 800,000. You know, I always say, if you haven't bought residential before, go and cut your teeth on residential. Buy that property for 800,000 in residential. Buying a property, a commercial property, around about that sub 800. Yes, they are out there, but I'm going to be 100% often honest. They're expensive. Okay, yeah. Once you've gone through all your fees and your rates and whatever, you know, you're paying a lot of money for that. So you really want to be above that that million. 2 million is really where you want to be, and leverage as hard as you can. So using lines of credit, using equity out of your current properties, that sort of thing. Not to say that it can't be done, it can be done, but you know, you want to leverage as hard as possible. In terms of type of property, look, we chase numbers. So when somebody comes to me and they say they want a particular type of property, I always ask if there's a little bit of leeway with that. Everybody at the moment, the sweetheart at the moment is industrial. Everybody wants industrial. however, there are a lot of good opportunities in the other two sectors, in office as well as in retail. And again, when we look at an asset, we look at the full gestalt of the asset. So what it is, what the leases are, who the tenant is, what the longevity is. And the most important thing when looking at an asset is exit strategies. So in other words, like I mentioned, the pizza shop. So in purchasing a property like that, you want to be thinking to yourself, what else can go in there? What other types of businesses can be serviced in that area and under that roof?
Yeah, beautifully said. It really is. If you're getting into commercial, you've really got to treat your investment as a business in every aspect of the exercise, from the due diligence you mentioned right through to being really clear on what the options of that property are long term. So it's certainly not something for the faint-hearted or the beginners, and certainly a need to be working with someone like yourself who understands the ins and outs of the sector and can guide them through that, so that they've got an elite team around them stepping through things that they may not be aware of unless they're dealing with someone like you who understands what works and what doesn't in that regard. So look, I really want to thank you for these quite enlightening insights on the differences and benefits of investing in commercial real estate, Mish. And now that you've whet our appetites, we're really looking forward to deep diving with you on this growing investment class during our upcoming two-part special on the Property Hub's long-form Get Invested podcast. So I want to mention for everyone to keep their ears and eyes out for that. And I recommend that they also tune into your Revolve Commercial Property podcast. And for those that are real eager beavers having listened to us today, I encourage them to reach out to you at Revolve Commercial at revolvecommercial.com.au, and we'll have the show and the link in the show notes. So thanks again for sharing all of this with us on the show today, Mish.
Thank you, Bushy. It's been lovely being here and chatting to you. Thank you very much.
Are you curious about harnessing your super for property investment? Propel your future with the enlightening online seminar, The Ultimate Masterclass to Self-Managed Superfund Property Mastery. Reserve your spot now at getrare.com.au/SMSF. Spearheaded by Rasty from independent buyers agency Get Rare Properties, this masterclass unravels strategic property investment using your self-managed superannuation fund. You know, it's not just about learning. It's about transforming your financial future through education. So embrace this opportunity to enrich your investing acumen. Enroll now in the free masterclass and begin a journey that marries insight with action, leading to a financially empowered tomorrow.
Unlock bonus content now as a premium subscriber.
And that brings us to the end of this week's show. It's our 600th show. Once again, I say thanks to all those people who've contributed over those so many years. It's a really great milestone. Make sure that you don't miss a single episode of Realty Talk or Bushy's Get Invested podcast delivered to you each week by subscribing to The Property Hub now on your favorite podcast player, or wherever you're listening to or watching this show. Also, you can join the conversation anytime on Facebook by going to the Property Hub Collective. Thanks once again to our supporters and content partners, realty.com.au, BMT Tax Depreciation, who I might mention have been with us almost right from the very start of our show. So thanks to Brad and the team. Also, Know How Property Finance, Get Rare Property and Apiro Marketing. On that note, I'm Kevin Turner, and on behalf of Bushy and the whole Property Hub team, we look forward to seeing you again next week.